Thank you so much for tuning into the Psychology Is podcast. I'm Nick Fortino, and I'm here today with a major figure in the field of psychology, Dr. Kirk Schneider. Thank you so much for joining me.
Well, thanks for inviting me, Nick.
It's an honor to have you. Dr. Schneider is the author or co-author of 12 books. He's a licensed psychologist, and you practice what you describe as existential integrative therapy. Yes. You're currently a candidate for the next president of the American Psychological Association. I'm curious to know, I don't know exactly, how is that voting done? How is that president elected?
Well, it begins September 15th, and all APA members receive an electronic ballot, and they have about a month and a half to vote. The voting closes on October 29th. So it's a rather arduous process, but I think psychologists are known for being reflective types. So it probably takes some people a little more time than others to sort out the candidates. We have five candidates running, very, very good candidates. So I'm one among four others.
Well, I hope you win.
Thanks very much.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So there's so much we can talk about because you've just contributed so much to the field of psychology. And, you know, I have a few planned questions, but there's always room for spontaneity and for the conversation to flow where it will flow. So Let's start just with the question. What do you mean by the term existential integrative therapy?
Well, existential integrative therapy emerged from existential humanistic therapy, and in particular, Rollo May's opening to his book Existence in 1958, where he basically imported existential psychology from Europe. And in the opening paragraph, he identifies existential psychology as an attempt to ground or understand all the bona fide approaches within psychology, because it aims at illuminating our experience of being. So it's a very fundamental perspective. And I had the great honor to co-author a book with Rollo. He invited me back in 1991. He was asked by McGraw-Hill to write a new textbook for the emerging generation at the time. And so that's the point where I was thinking more and more about how important this idea of seeing the existential perspective in a wider and more diversified way, because it had been associated with a kind of rarefied intellectual or abstract perspective only for, Upper West Siders or the elite, if you will. It was a misnomer to a good degree, but it had some validity. But actually, not only Rollo's perspective being a base and kind of a wellspring from which to understand many points of view in psychotherapy and psychology, but also a number of existential-oriented practitioners were including some of the other bona fide approaches. I'm talking about, say, referring their patients to physicians or to psychiatrists for medical management, let's say, at times, or using some of the techniques of cognitive behavioral therapy, certainly drawing from psychoanalytic therapy. And so the issue really was more of how do we best meet that person in that moment, psychotherapeutically. And that made a lot of sense to me. And then I'm also realizing at the time how little the mainstream field of psychology, and particularly therapy, seems to know about existential principles, even though May and Bugenthal's books were quite widely disseminated, especially May's. But they, May's book especially, tended to be more for popular consumption, and Bugenthal's was somewhat confined within the existential humanistic psychology community. So my point being that it seemed to me that we had a lot of riches to offer mainstream psychology and therapy. And I worked with ways of making that more explicit by coming up with one way of understanding and coordinating a variety of bona fide therapeutic approaches within an overall existential or experiential context. So I know that's a mouthful, but that's the basic definition of EI therapy. It's one way of understanding and coordinating a variety of therapeutic approaches within an overall existential or experiential context. To go into that more, I mean, basically what I mean by that is the therapist being available, not imposing it on the client, but being available to what we might call deeper or more experiential shifts in their healing work. So by experiential, I mean an emphasis on the immediate, the affective, the kinesthetic, and the profound, or cosmic, if you will, spiritual. So obviously not everybody is either ready for or desirous of that kind of depth in the therapy. Mm. On the other hand, there are a lot more people, many of us have found, that are ready for and desirous of that perspective if it were to be offered to them, and if they felt that the therapist had an openness to it and right from the beginning approached them, you know, more as a human being, if you will, than as a patient per se, or as a doctor with a white coat who's going to give that patient a formula so that changes them, you know, whether it's through conditioning principles or medicine or what have you. Hmm. Now, again, not to say that those approaches aren't valid. And within this schema, they're seen as very valid. It depends on the context, the client's desire and capacity for fuller, more experiential change. Of course, I could go into what more of what I mean by that kind of work at the experiential level. But I want to give you a breath.
A moment of processing, I suppose. We will go there. But so I just want to kind of highlight the key terms you brought in that are key elements of this therapeutic approach, which is the emphasis on the immediate, the kinesthetic, the affective, and the profound.
Yes.
I do think that's missing from many forms of therapy, in my own experience with therapy, in studying different modalities. I don't think that those are key ingredients of every form of therapy, that's for sure. And I think they're essential. That present moment orientation, I think, is sometimes overlooked. I think many people experience therapy in a way where they come in and they report to the therapist all of the frustrating things or depressing or anxiety producing things they've been experiencing. And they kind of talk through that, but there's an overlooking of the present moment experience, in particular, those different dimensions, the body, the emotions, and the sense of the profound. Yes. I love the use of that word too, because I might be inclined to use the word spiritual there, but I like the word profound more. It doesn't have the same connotation as spiritual. And I think more people can relate to what that might mean. One thing I wanted to ask you mentioned the tenets of existentialism. So I think the word existential is well known, like the word is more well known than the real meaning is well known. You know, I think some people kind of liken the word existential to the word just deep. And, you know, like that's so existential, as in like that's such a deep thing to think about. And as we know, it's that's not exactly what existential means, philosophically speaking. So will you elucidate that? What are these tenets of existentialism?
Well, there's different ways to approach that question. Technically, existential means to emerge or become. But at a more earthy frame, it basically means what engages you, what's alive right now. I see the whole work really as revolving around two basic questions. How are you presently living? And these, by the way, are both implicit and explicit questions. Sometimes we actually ask these questions of clients. But more often, they are threads through the entire work. How are you presently living? So the client checks in, explores, sort of ranges within. Then on the heels of that question is, and it's often naturally emerges, is how are you willing to live? So you're beginning to identify how are you presently living in the here and now and with your whole bodily experience to the degree possible. So not just your head, not just the external behaviors that you make, but with, you know, your cognition, your behavior, your affect, your intuition. How are you presently living right now when you check in? What does it feel like? What are you sensing? What are you thinking? And then naturally emerging from that often is, okay, that's how you're presently living. You're feeling very constricted, let's say. Relationship with your husband is, you know, is in, you know, turmoil. Your job is lacking in real charge or meaning. Your life is feeling humdrum, whatever. You're concerned, you're terribly concerned about what's going on in the world with the pandemic. Maybe racism is a huge burden for you. So many ways that we can begin to see a gestalt or a kind of sensibility when we check in with how are we presently living. It also begins the process of cultivating presence, which is a key theme in our work. Presence is really the ground and ultimate aim of the work, which I can go into, but then that eventually begs the question of, okay, this is how you're living. Well, how do you want to live? And not only how do you want to live or wish to live, which are really important questions, but how are you willing to live? There's a kind of freedom and responsibility question there. So you have the freedom to explore, freedom to look at possibilities. But then the question is, how are you going to do it? Where are you going to do it? Are you going to implement it? Are you going to apply it to your life? How are you going to respond to what is palpably there? So the work is really modeled around those questions, and again, those questions open up very much to an integrated and existential integrated perspective, because how are you willing to live can be answered at so many levels. I identify for didactic purposes several levels that people seem to emphasize in their existence, more this physiological, which would include the medical, the dietary, exercise realm, et cetera, physical exercise. Then there's cognitive behavioral level of conditioning and reconditioning, restructuring cognitions, helping a person to think more rationally about their lives rather than thinking in very black and white terms or overgeneralizing, et cetera. Some people are dealing more at the, what you might call loosely psychodynamic level or psychoanalytic level, where their early childhood experiences, especially with parents, have major impact on their current functioning. And so the task there is to illuminate those experiences and try to help the person to see how those experiences are relating to their current lives. And through those interpretations, look at how they want to proceed. Can they sort of, extricate themselves from those early conflicts? And then the experiential or being them, which is sort of core or crown of the existential perspective. And that's where, well, we believe that for many people, that's where the deepest healing occurs. Not for everybody, and it's not necessary for everyone, because they're just not in a place for it, or they're not interested in going into that, deep, immediate, affective, kinesthetic, and profound place. But the being or experiential level tends to be less verbal, and it makes a lot of sense, because at that point, words really restrict, and in some cases even devalue the experiences that the person is having with their struggle, with their concern. And so what we're trying to do at that being or experiential level is to help them to stay as present as possible to all the feelings, body sensations, images that come up around a given issue or battle. Certainly thoughts as well, but most of an invitation is to take a moment. Like I might say, Nick, if you would take a moment and just check in with what you're feeling in your body right now as you're sitting with me here. Or I notice a little tension. I'm just using this as an example, Nick. I notice a little tension in your neck area. I wonder if you notice anything there as well. A person may be talking and may gently challenge them in the midst of talking. But, I hear what you're saying, but I also see some moistening of your eye. I just wonder, is that registering with you? It's amazing how the attention to what's happening in one's body can sometimes open up the floodgates of one's struggle. So it's very important to emphasize that this approach is very much based on an art as well as a science. Mm. Clinical knowledge and intuition are extremely important in working from this perspective. Mm. And a lot of training on the part of the therapist, cultivating an ability to be present within themselves, is huge as well, because it's very difficult for you to be present with another person in their ugliest places, in places that are going to activate your own terrors and estrangements. If you don't have, you know, a good deal of that capacity yourself. So I highly recommend that therapists who work in this area receive some kind of depth experiential therapy themselves to go to these places, you know, with clients.
Mm. I'll mention.
Sense, where are we at?
It's definitely making sense. You're painting the picture clearly. I'm kind of getting a better understanding of just how multidimensional this form of therapy is. And I wonder if that's partly where the word integrative comes from, is in the way that you're integrating these different modalities and acknowledging the value of each one, all within this context of present moment orientation and those two questions: how are you presently living and how are you willing to live? One thing that comes to my mind is, and I'm sure you know this, often I mention things for the listeners, but the work of Eugene Gendlin and his work on focusing, he even has a book called Focusing, just a small book, easy to read and digest. And it's, I just feel like if anyone's especially interested in the techniques that Kirk is talking about here, related to, he even has, I think, a paper entitled Through the Body, There's a Door. And so everything you were just describing about the way that if you recognize tension in my shoulders or some type of physical internal sensation, if you simply rest awareness upon that, you might be unlocking emotions. Like you said, the floodgates may open. So through the body, there is a door to some significant psychological processing that can occur, or emotional processing.
Well, it's embodied.
Embodied, yeah.
And we know that trauma is often quite embodied. I mean, people like van der Kolk, leading trauma experts, have shown this through their case studies and what we're finding out psychophysiologically as well. So a lot of that trauma is being released in a sense,
yeah,
through these more pre-verbal kinesthetic, if you will, approaches.
Yes.
Versus talking about them.
Exactly.
You're directly experiencing.
Exactly.
So Gendlin is a very good example.
Mm.
Although I would distinguish a little bit with Gendlin. Gendlin's approach is a little bit more of a technical procedure.
Mm.
Our work, which is elaborated in existential integrative psychotherapy, and my recent book with Thora Krug, a wonderful colleague, collaborator in existential humanistic therapy, is our senses, our process is a little more organic, you know, evolving as we're sensing what's emerging for the client, which may take us in a number of directions. Both in terms of the experiential level of contact, or perhaps sort of drawing back a little bit and checking in with what might help relate to the client better.
Mm. It's a good point too, that Gendlin offers, like you said, a technical procedure, a very step-by-step process. And I understand that this approach is more fluid, I suppose. What you said about trauma as being embodied, I couldn't agree more. And I feel like this is actually one of the things that's become increasingly clear to me throughout the past couple of years in my studies, is the way that I would go as far to say that if trauma therapy doesn't include a kinesthetic component, if it's not embodied, it'll be incomplete. I think that many times people will come to some sort of intellectual insight about their trauma, but it doesn't actually resolve it. The conditioned responses are still there. The state of their nervous system is the same. The patterns of their emotions and their sensitivities won't change unless there is actual work within the body. So,
right on. I mean, I think, you know, really this is one of the concerns that existentially oriented practitioners had with both the psychoanalytic and the cognitive behavioral movements from very early on, was that they tended to be a little overly cognitivistic. And so talking about the issue or even interpreting it and helping somebody understand it can be very helpful. I've been through psychoanalysis myself. I was greatly benefited by it as a child, actually. However, for me and for others, it wasn't until I was actually able to stay present, not only in the therapy office, but in my everyday life and when anxieties came up, to more of my whole body experience of it, that I felt like a larger person, and more of a whole person, and more of an alignment with what deeply mattered. Let's put it this way, I was not as thrown by all these obstacles in my path. Got out of my own way more, because I have a greater capacity to experience more of who I am rather than just certain parts. It's what we get in the conditioning realms too, I think. You get a certain shift, which can be invaluable, again, for certain people at certain times. But for many, it's not getting at their core and their core agencies as well. I mean, you often have to get down and dirty with your own being to be more fully friendly, or more fully friends with your own being. And that's a lot of what we're talking about, is befriending more of who you are. So you can come from a place of greater choices, greater possibilities, and ultimately a sense of what deeply matters, and an ability to move in that direction, because you've got the will. It's not a will imposed from us without, just the intellect or medicine, etc. So these things can work together too. I mean, sometimes it's helpful for people to get footholds through medicine or cognitive behavioral work, some of the psychoanalytic work, but then they're looking for something more. It's not quite getting to that deeper place they feel.
Right.
Our culture really, in many ways, reinforces that sort of analytical, you know, distancing. It's a kind of efficiency-oriented model. You know, so much emphasis on the quick fix and instant results and computerization. And of course, these things have greatly improved our standard of living in many ways. That they yield great benefits in certain ways. For example, us being able to communicate through this marvelous device, being far apart physically. But it seems to me and colleagues that there is a significant price to pay, and we are paying it in our culture with what might be called return of the repressed, backlashes, because there are so many parts of us that are being neglected. I think one of the core parts is being in fuller touch with, again, what deeply matters to each other. So often that has to do with relationships to each other, relationships to ourselves, creativity, a greater sense of meaning in life. And I've also brought in the dimension of the sense of awe toward living, AWE. So I believe in a number of cases, and I feel with my own therapy, it was very supportive of me not only identifying what was more meaningful as a direction in my life, particular goals, and how to pursue those, but a whole different attitude toward living. And that took a while, but I really try to tap into that place of, again, being as much as I can, being able to experience the world and existence with my whole body, sensibilities. And when I do that, get in touch with, I feel like I'm participating in something much greater than myself. And I feel simultaneously my sense of smallness, vulnerability, but also greatness and capacity to transcend and to, again, participate in something much greater than ourselves, the mystery of being. And I think that's one of the most wonderful gifts that one can be bestowed upon, to have that feeling that can happen anywhere, really. But I mean, we often get it being in oceans or with sunsets. But if we can get in touch with that sensibility more often in our lives, I think it's a pretty strong counter to depression and anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're unhooking from those narrow spaces, those narrow judgments, and you're recognizing in the long run, and ultimately there's so much more going on, and you're a part of it in your own way, and that edges over into a kind of spiritual order. Called awe-based sensibility toward life, not toward an individual or an object per se. Although those can be conduits to that fuller sensibility.
I want to respond to what you're bringing up right now about awe and presence in the moment. And, you know, in my assessment, this might be one of those things that people have heard so often that we've almost become dismissive of it, of the power of channeling awareness into the present moment wholeheartedly. And like you said, it's an amazing counter to depression and anxiety. And of course, we can acknowledge that depression and anxiety often has causes that are complex, and we're not oversimplifying it here by just saying that all you need to do is pay attention to the present moment. But at the same time, we wouldn't want to overlook the power of presence in countering depression and anxiety. And so, like you said also, it's somewhat easy to experience awe when we are standing before the majesty of nature at an ocean or a forest or a waterfall or the night sky. But of course, this is available to us in any moment, even in moments that are seemingly mundane. And so the way, you know, I want to know, like, what advice would you give someone who asks you or who says to you, I understand this whole thing about being present in the moment, but I just can't seem to do that. How would you guide someone in enhancing their presence in the moment?
One frame, so to speak, that I use is to point people's attention to several sort of awe-based themes. One is, can you tune into the passing nature of time and life right now in this moment? Can you bring your awareness to how everything that's going on now is gone and will be gone momentarily? And that in so many ways that brings our attention to the poignancy of this moment, to really tapping in to what is happening here and now, what engages us. And we could say that about this dialogue. It's kind of a gestalt switch, you know, from focusing on particular categories to the amazement of having a dialogue, of exploring together, of this precious time to tap into. So that's one element. Another is to be open to wonder and surprise at any moment. You know, can you go to that next meeting with a little different approach, or really a radically different approach, instead of anticipating all the comments that are about to be made at that meeting, say the presentation you're going to give, or the usual, you know, banter that you engage in. Can you go into that meeting radically open to something different might happen today? Yes, that same old person or that same old group. Can something different happen? Maybe something different can happen. Can I be open to that person? And this could go with a lover as well as a business mate, friend, what have you. Or someplace that you're visiting. Can I go in with sort of fresh eyes? Can I allow myself to be jarred, to be surprised? What I'm traveling through. I mean, awe is so connected with adventure. I call it the humility and wonder or sense of adventure toward living. When you think about an adventure, that's it. I mean, you're going into the mystery, whatever it is, a forest, something unfolding. Another way to bring in a more of an awe dimension is to tune into your connection with something greater than yourself. Like taking us right now. Yes, we're having a conversation over an electronic medium, but this conversation and these electronics are set on a table that's set on a floor, that's set on a ball that is whirling around the sun at 67,000 miles per hour, that is nested in a galaxy that is hurtling through the universe at 1.3 million miles per hour to a destination that's completely unknown. Okay, now I realize we don't get up and eat our breakfast and think about these things typically, but maybe you get my point. And certainly you don't have to think about how we're on a whirling ball hurtling through the universe to complete inky unknowability. But we can certainly recognize that there's something much more than our very petty and narrow identifications going on within and around us. And just taking a moment to shift to that amazement can certainly bring that sensibility. Also tuning into what I call intricacy, the details of things, the details of person you're with, maybe your own reflections or memories, how each interaction is a kind of microcosm within a macrocosm. And there is so much more in the subtleties often than we realize. We tend to pass them by very quickly. So maybe we notice, you know, some warm feeling as we're sitting with someone. How much time do we give that to notice? And then what does that open up to? Or I often think of the example on my walks. I often take walks in the morning. Smells will bring me right back to like when I was a kid. Even if it's a diesel smell, it's like, but what I, that memory of being next to a tractor in an open field as a kid was so exciting for me. And that brought, you know, all these other associations with running free and blue skies and the grass, you know, rolling around in the grass, the blades of grass, other kids. I mean, you see what I mean, how details can just open up. And also tuning into our emotional life can bring a greater sense of awe. In a very present way, I'm not talking about just crude emotion, but our sentiment toward ourselves, toward others, can take us to a very deep and sensitive place that tunes into a wonder, amazement, and maybe even a veneration for the moment. I often think of this with my own son. Like when we, let's say, go to the ocean together and boogie board or whatever. But just occasionally I'll tune into such a profound feeling when I hear being with him. And it goes beyond us. You know, it's very hard to describe.
Mm.
It's connected with something even much greater. And of course, ancestry and farther and wider and deeper. Because it's the sense of participating in something much greater, which again can lift us out of those usual humdrum identifications that we're so trapped in.
How beautiful. Just to kind of a recap, as I heard you put it, there's to become aware of the passing of time. And even as you were describing that, I definitely experienced a perceptual shift. It felt very significant, actually, to become aware that in this moment, there's this constant passing of time and everything that is appearing is morphing. And then there's to have this openness to surprise and wonder. Love that too. And I think there's a certain rigidity that our perceptual patterns can take that make life feel mundane and predictable in a very boring way. And that, you know, maybe sometimes the solution to that is to change up your circumstances, but sometimes there's an internal shift that can be made to shift that. And I think adopting that attitude of wonder and surprise and kind of look for the unexpected, that also feels significant. And then tuning into something greater than yourself, going macro with your perspective, and then also going micro with your perspective, the details, the subtlety, and then to tune into your own emotional experience and the depth that emotion can bring to the present moments. So all of this is, you know, ways to enhance the sense of awe that I think I honestly think that on some level, we all have an awareness that we should be experiencing that. And I, you know, hesitate to use the word should, but I suppose we all have an awareness that is possible, that life is really that majestic and beautiful and incredibly amazing, that it's possible to experience awe. And I think we have that awareness that this is possible, but we also often have the awareness that we don't feel any sense of awe whatsoever, which, you know, I suppose is a bit of a discrepancy. And so these are really helpful tools for enhancing that sense of awe that I think deep down we all know is possible.
I appreciate that. I mean, I think many of us hunger for that.
Mm.
But it's very hard to cultivate a sense of awe if one has not cultivated an ability to be more fully present.
Mm.
And that's why presence is so key to the healing work in therapy for many, and to the inner work of opening spaces to experience awe in one's life. It's very hard to experience awe when one is in a state of terror or a great deal of fear and anxiety.
Mm.
However, I don't want to imply that those dimensions cannot be conducive to awe, because I believe much that they can. In fact, those dimensions can help us go to very deep places if we can approach them more from a place of curiosity and discovery, rather than just clamping down, you know, rigidity and imprisonment by the sadnesses, by the anxieties that we have, the anger we may have. Each of these dimensions can be worlds. They can open up worlds in themselves. I think of a Rilke poem you may be familiar with, Letters to a Young Poet, where Rilke, René Maria Rilke, the Austrian poet, writes to a depressed young man about how depression doesn't have to be an imprisonment. It can be a signal that something new is attempting to emerge within you. And can you but stay with the process of what is unfolding to bring in perhaps new sensitivities that you hadn't experienced before, to loved ones or to what you love about life? A poignancy. And this is where I think there can be real problems with, you know, too much positivity in psychology and in our some of our national emphases. On, you know, kind of a simple view of happiness.
Mm.
You know, I believe an awe-based life is one that it is in touch with the whole enchilada, you know, the good, the bad, and the ugly. our deepest dreads, our vulnerabilities, which very much add to the deepening of our lives, as well as our dazzling capacities to self-create, to transcend, to feel part of something much greater than ourselves.
Mm.
But it's the intermixture that's rich.
Mm.
It's brings an intensity to living that we don't often appreciate, I think.
That's beautiful. An intensity to living. I get what you mean by that.
Yeah. What I wonder what comes up for you.
Just when I hear you say that, as I process that and feel it now, I relate it to a sense of aliveness that can intensify.
Mm-hmm.
an awareness of my own existence that can intensify. And as that intensifies, there's a sense of significance that also intensifies. And even the one more descriptor I would add is just a freshness. It is so interesting being human, the way that life unfolds, and we like to think we can make predictions and we have our expectations, but it's so unpredictable. Life is so unpredictable, which is sometimes, you know, we get weak in the knees with fear about that, which I understand, because it's truly unpredictable. Anything can happen for the most part. But when I kind of allow myself to feel that, there's that increased intensity to my aliveness. So that's what comes up for me when I process that. And I'll just add, you know, I think that there are perhaps, there's this development that someone experiences in their capacity to be present in the moment. And I kind of see it as there's presence to more or less degrees of intensity. Like, how completely immersed are you in this moment? And then there's also the factor of how sustained that is. And it seems to me that, you know, people who really have cultivated this capacity, they experience a total immersion in the present moment, and that is sustained perhaps constantly. And then I think there are people who experience flashes, moments of intense presence, but there's this just, they drift back into the tornado of thoughts that kind of pull them out of presence. So I see kind of both of those elements in our capacity to be present, how intensely, how completely, and how sustained is it? So,
good example.
Yeah.
I see it on a spectrum also. It seems to me that the greater the capacity for presence, for staying with experiences with one's whole bodily sensibilities, the more likelihood that one can experience greater intensities.
Mm.
Now, how far that can go is an open question.
Mm.
But it certainly feels like a path worth pursuing, as long as it is pursued sensitively and mindfully and not in some haphazard way or reckless kind of way, because we sometimes see people become shipwrecked, so to speak.
Mm. And what would be an example of like a haphazard way of approaching this?
I was giving the example of how much, let's say, existential integrative therapy is an art. So if one is encouraging person who's in a very fragile place to move beyond their pace, let's say, or calling attention to an overwhelming a number of dimensions of their bodily being, that can be overwhelming. Just as crash courses in meditation can be overwhelming for some people. There's really a pacing quality to this. There's hopefully an attuning quality and maybe a facilitating quality with someone else. It's often helpful to have a mentor of some kind,
or
healer, who has, again, this capacity. Yeah, there's a kind of a dialectic between understandable needs for boundaries and awarenesses of limits the same time as the capacity to push those limits, to work with the edges of those limits. And that often is our anxiety.
Mm.
Rollo May talked about anxiety as the flip side of freedom, which is very interesting. The more free we feel, often the more we're plowing new fields that can bring new anxieties.
Right.
But the question comes up, to what degree can we coexist with that anxiety? Maybe fashion something beautiful from it. Or to what extent do we get consumed?
That's fascinating, that idea there. The book of Rollo May's that I read was Love and Will.
Yes.
And I try to use the word profound carefully because sometimes I think it's used a little bit loosely, but using the word carefully, that book had a profound impact on me. And I remember reading, you know, sections of that book. He raises this topic that you're raising now, the anxiety, how anxiety is kind of the flip side of freedom, and how, you know, with freedom comes responsibility, because only if you're free are you responsible for what you do. And that responsibility invokes anxiety, because in a sense, if a person is not free, if all their choices are made for them, if their path is predestined, well, then what do you have to worry about? You know, you're just along for the ride, and you're not responsible for anything. But although some people who are determinists might disagree with this, that to me, that doesn't seem how life is. It seems that we do have freedom over our lives and our choices, and therefore we are responsible for our lives and our choices. And of course, this is raising a very complex philosophical question of free will, but just to kind of zero in on the way that anxiety is linked to freedom, I think that's absolutely true. But it, as Rollo May would always emphasize, it's an anxiety we should embrace. It's an anxiety that is worth feeling, and that if we face it, I remember he even said in an interview, you know, when I allow myself to feel that anxiety, I am compelled to act meaningfully in the world. So I think that's important.
I think you bring up a great point about being directed by others as far as our life paths. But also, I would distinguish between this genuine freedom and whimsy. You know, it's not just helter-skelter, anything goes kind of freedom, which can be extremely reckless, irresponsible. But with genuine freedom comes greater awareness, and with greater awareness naturally comes more of a sensitivity about how this is impacting you, impacting others, what it means for our planet, for our society. It's almost like you can't help but come into those attunements. And then the question is, how do you work with those in terms of whatever path you're pursuing?
So we've been talking for over an hour here, and I'm loving our conversation. So I'll just say, introduce this new segment to the Psychology Is podcast. And Kirk, you're the first guest who gets to be part of this. So hopefully you find it enjoyable. So we've been publishing this podcast for a while now. We've got over 35 episodes, and we are just, you know, we're not going to stop anytime soon. And we also create, you know, short educational entertaining videos on YouTube. This podcast is available on YouTube and also on all the podcast streaming platforms. And we've been starting to get questions from listeners and watchers You know, often they're directed to me, but they're good questions. And I love a good question. I think my students even give me a hard time that the phrase I say most often as a teacher is good question. But people always keep asking me good questions. So I can't help it. So exactly. Yeah, there you go. So this we're introducing this segment into the podcast here, where toward the end of my conversations with guests, I'm going to raise one of the questions that our audience has submitted. And so I just want to say to people listening and watching, you can submit a question, and we'll at each podcast episode, we'll raise one of these questions, perhaps one of our favorites. And you can leave that question as a comment on YouTube, or if you're listening to this on Spotify or Apple or another streaming platform, you can submit a question to us on YouTube, on Twitter at Nick Fortino PhD. We're on Instagram, psychology.is. We're on Facebook, just psychology is. So on any of these social media platforms, you can submit a question. And I want to raise a question we got to you here, Kirk. I think it's a tough question to answer because it's very broad, but I think it's an important question. So I'll read it off here. So someone reached out and said, I have been working in the mental health field for about 20 years as a licensed clinical social worker. And this person had listened to a recent episode with Dr. Peter Gutsche that we did and found it very useful. And then this person goes on to say, sadly, I do not feel I am very effective as a clinician. And I do not believe the standard of care is very effective. The reason I'm reaching out to you is that I would like to be effective. I want to genuinely help others, but do not know how. My field in particular can enable some cognitive distortions and learned helplessness that we all know can lead to poor mental health. So the question is, what, in your opinion, is the most effective treatment for mental illness? And where do I go to learn this?
That is a huge question.
It is.
Well, first of all, I would begin with oneself. I don't know if this person has had depth experiential therapy for him or herself, but I would highly recommend that so that the person can expand their availability to the client, wider and deeper ranges of availability for healing with the client, because they themselves have an ability to model the presence that they're supporting in the client. I would refer them to, if they're interested in, let's say, existential, integrative, existential humanistic approaches to therapy, refer them to our institute. We have a certificate program in the foundations of existential humanistic practice. It's called EHI, the Existential Humanistic Institute, and it's ehinstitute.org. You can find out about our programs. We have some very concerted elements to our program. One of them is a six-day workshop, which is coming up actually in October, I think about the 10th, at a retreat setting in Sonoma County, California, Northern California. And students find this setting and the instructors that attend and the groups that attend to be very cultivating of presence and of learning, you know, practical ways to facilitate the kind of work that I'm talking about, which I do believe, well, certainly in my own experience, it is effective. But I believe it's quite supported by the latest mainstream outcome research too, by people like Bruce Wampold and John Norcross, so-called contextual relational factors research, where they point to not so much the techniques or even the theories that the therapist brings, but again, these more pre-verbal kinesthetic dimensions of empathy, sense of alliance with the client, that is the sense of the feeling like you're in their corner. Powerful active listening skills, being able to support a client's exploration process and experiencing process, collaborating with the client moment to moment. And that's part of what I was talking about before, attempting to meet the client where they live. How are they doing right now? Checking in with the client, collaborating with the client about what best meets them in this moment. How can I best accompany them? And of course, this is partly intuitive too. And you take some risks, but sometimes those risks, even if they are difficult for the client or anxiety provoking, that can open up some very informative spaces, to go further into the work or to find out more about how this person constructs himself in his or her world. So, I was talking about practical applications in that training and working with what used to be called resistances, and we call them self-protections, because often those come up as people deepen their presence to their battle. And then cultivating a sense of meaning and awe, potentially, in the sort of final phases, the culminating phases of that work, where the person is seeing more and more close up both how they're living their lives and how they really want to live their lives. And if you keep revisiting that, you build what Otto Rank calls a counter will or a frustration in the client toward not being willing to take it anymore. The old routine way of living, as familiar and comfortable as it was, the person increasingly realizes how crippling and miserable that is for them because of the mirroring, the active and passive mirroring that the therapist is bringing to that client to see how they're living their lives and how they're willing to live their lives. So then comes, hopefully, a breakthrough of some kind toward being able to move beyond or at least coexist with in a much more spacious way their old patterns and open out into a more meaningful and engaged, awe-based life. So those are some suggestions. Try to be compassionate with yourself in the process. I would also say to try to identify where you feel you get stuck and really try to work on those places in particular in trainings or in terms of your own reflection about what's going on.
Beautiful.
I know it can work. I am a product myself. Mm-hmm. Some very good therapy. Mm. Depth therapy.
Beautiful. I believe that every insight is the child of a meaningful inquiry. Everything intelligent anyone has ever said has come about as an answer to a good question or the pursuit of inquiry. So I think the person very much who submitted this question. And I thank you for that nice, well-rounded, powerful answer.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
And it feels like the person is on the path simply by inquiring, like you said.
Yes, I agree. I know. I was so impressed by the question. You know, it takes a lot to admit that, you know, the work I've been involved in for 20 years isn't effective, as not nearly as effective as I think it can be. It takes a lot to admit that. And so I really respected the question and glad I brought it up in this conversation.
Actually, on that point, we didn't really get to the mental illness aspect in a broader way, but I do want to stress that there is no panacea, as far as I know, out there, and this is not a panacea, and there are some people who are just going to be stuck where they are or just in very tormented, difficult places in their lives. You know, as you move more toward the psychotic spectrum, it obviously becomes more challenging in this way. We have medications that can help. But I would also say that drawing from this approach, this experiential depth approach, can be more helpful than we often realize, even with people with very severe disturbances. And people like R.D. Lang, with his alternative psychiatric facilities, safe houses, back in the 60s, was drawing from this basic approach and being present to people as they go through some very difficult psychotic processes and come into larger capabilities within themselves. Many of them did. And Lauren Mosher, who is a psychiatrist from our country who studied with Lang, brought that approach to what he calls Soteria House and did a fascinating study on it a number of years ago that showed after 1 year follow-up with approximately 100 people in an experimental group that was in the safe houses and a control group that went through regular psychiatric facilities, the ones who went through the more existentially based safe houses were about functioning about the same level as those from the experimental group, but better on two key areas. One was recidivism. They tended to go back into psychiatric facilities less. And the other was independent living. They were able to live on their own much more. So I would say try to stay as open-minded as possible to the potency of developing co-presence in therapy and applying skillful means through training to that process.
It was a huge question. You answered it very well. Well, this has just been great. And I'm so grateful that you spent this much time with me. I always turn attention back to the listeners and watchers here at the end of the podcast and just say that, you know, those of you who are still listening and watching at this point, fuel me to continue with this project, to know that there are people who want long form conversations like this. It's just, that's why I do this. So, and it's also personally beneficial, the opportunity to talk to giants in the field like you. I know you wouldn't describe yourself that way probably, but I sure will. It does a lot for me professionally and personally. So thank you to the listeners for listening. Thank you, Dr. Kirk Schneider, for sharing your wisdom and time with us. I'm just inspired by how much you've contributed to the field of psychology, and I'm so intrigued, and we'll continue to learn more about this approach to therapy. I think it just sounds human, sounds so human-centered.
Good summary. I'm deeply appreciative to you, Nick, Dr. Fortino, for providing these precious moments. I really felt that along the way. So keep it going.
Thank you. Thank you.
This is vital.
Yeah, well, thank you so much. And again, I hope you win the presidency of the APA. I'll stay tuned about that. And I'm so glad we're connected. We'll stay in touch.
Good.
All right. Take care.